So, welcome to Puckle Church. I wish it was a sunnier morning that I could welcome you to Puckle Church, because actually you'd be able to see the landscape that I'm about to introduce you to. Where you're standing now has been the centre of our community for more than 1,000 years. So we're standing on Puckle Church Recreation Ground. On the tithe maps, this is a field that's identified as the Burrell. And one of the suggestions about this area just here is that this was the centre of the Anglo-Saxon defended settlement, which was here just over 1,000 years ago. I've got some maps with me today, which I'll hand out. They are actually a walking tour of the village. And this morning, my brief really for the Radical History Group was to tell you something about Edmund and his assassination in Pucklechurch. And we've extended that a little bit because I wanted to tell you about some of the other radical parts of Pucklechurch's history. So this morning is not really just a let's walk around Pucklechurch and I'll tell you everything I know about its history. It's going to highlight two or three different areas which are associated either with government or the war or spies or explorers. And then obviously we'll end with Edmund and a reenactment of his assassination, apparently. So we'll leave that up to Kevin and his friends.
Who's going to play
this? Okay, so this is the centre of our community. I'm going to pass these maps around because I need these to be able to explain to you what I mean about the Burrell and the fact that we think it is the centre of the Saxon community. So if you want to pass those around and then open up to the middle, I'll keep one. So. So I don't know which direction. I know a lot of you are from Pucklechurch itself, and obviously you have to bear with me if you already know a lot of what I'm about to tell you. But essentially, whichever way you come into the village, you will hit the centre of the field and skirt around this area just here. So this whole area is ringed by a road. There is no road which comes all the way through it. There's a road which comes in by the church, there's a road which comes in from the Absin direction, and there's a road which comes in from the Hinton direction. But there's nothing that has ever gone all the way through the centre of this. And the suggestion, if you look on your map just here, ignore the little loopy bit just here, but essentially it's that area just there that we're standing on. And that's the field which was called the Burrell. And the word for an Anglo-Saxon defended settlement was Burrell. So it's not hard to imagine that that may be some language that's been passed on through the generations which describes this area. And that the ditches and the banks that were associated with the Anglo-Saxon settlement may well be masked by the roads which skirt all the way around the outside of it. So this has definitely been an open area, probably for the last 1,000 years. And it's only very recently that buildings have been set onto the inside of it. It was owned by a brewery just over 100 years ago, and some of the brewery sold the field off and it became part of parish land, and some of the houses were built along the edge. And obviously we've got the church, which is set into one corner. We know that there was a church in Pucklechurch from the Anglo-Saxon period onwards. The whole of this area from the time of King Edmund was given over to Glastonbury Abbey, and I'll explain a little bit about that when we talk about Edmund. So we have a church set into one side of it. Within the landscape itself, though, the Anglo-Saxon settlement is not the earliest evidence we've got of human occupation and activity in the area. So up on the hill, you have to look very carefully in this direction. Just over there, you see the gap in the trees over there? There's an Iron Age hill fort. That's Hinton Hill Fort. Immediately to the right of that, if the sun was shining nicely, you can just about see it underneath the telephone wires, there's a whole set of medieval strip lynchet fields. And you can see the strip lynchets. They get highlighted by the sun and the shade, when it's sunshining, obviously. If we move further around into the landscape, there's a major prehistoric Mesolithic flint knapping site at Tog Hill. So we have, literally at the museum, we have thousands of pieces of flint, which are the leftover waste working of producing very, very small flints called microliths, which were used to make harpoons and things like that during the Mesolithic period. So we're talking, you know, in excess of 10,000 years ago, people up on the hillside living in and around this area. If we turn around and go in that direction, if you came up through Shortwood, And you ended up by the post box on the left-hand side. You might have noticed it's just there. In behind the hedge, there's a Bronze Age burial mound. Never been excavated. And I know that from aerial photographs, there are other Bronze Age burial mounds that have been found in that direction that have just literally left the mark in the grass where the mound was. So there's a huge amount of prehistoric activity. By far and away, though, the most evidence we've got for occupation in this area is Roman. Every time you look at the Sites and Monuments record, there's a big record that's kept by South Gloucestershire Council on behalf of all of its residents. It records all the historical pieces of information. It records all archaeological material that comes out of the ground on a huge database. And so if any of you put a planning application in for development within that area, it's checked against that database to find out if there's any archaeological sensitivity. And it's a way that the authorities have got of controlling what happens with that development. So it may well be that they require a developer to pay for an excavation or to pay for some kind of research to be done on that area prior to the development. So it's a planning tool as much as anything else, but it's also a record of what we've got. And the vast majority of the records for this area are Roman. Any excavations that have taken place in Puckle Church has turned up Roman material. We've had field walkers, metal detector users, landholders producing Roman material in the fields. And although I've told you all about the fact that we are an important Anglo-Saxon centre by the 10th century, as far as I'm aware, there's been one piece of Anglo-Saxon pottery that's ever come out of the ground in Puckle Church. And that came up when some parents were digging the post holes for children's play equipment on the school field, which is in that direction where those poplar trees are. So it's one piece of pottery, and I happened to be there on that day, and my friend said to me jokingly, "Oh, I found you some archaeology," and it's the one piece of Saxon pottery that has ever come out of the ground. We have nothing else which is Saxon. So Puckle Church is set into this fantastic array of history. So we've got prehistoric, we've got Roman, we've got Saxon, we've got medieval. And we've also got the industrial remains as well, because of the Parkfield Colliery, which was built in 1851. So down, I'll show you which direction, because I'm going to head out towards the edge of the village just there. In the middle of the 19th century, we had a massive population explosion in Puckle Church. Our residents' numbers doubled from around about 500 to 1,000, and they were all attracted by the work that was provided by Sir Handel Cosham's colliery, the Parkfield Colliery, and houses that were built for the colliery workers to work in. So, you know, we've got it from the prehistoric period right up to the present day. So the point of this morning is for me to highlight some of that history, in particular to do with the government and riots and spies, like I said before. And so we're going to start off with one of the most modern areas of the village and explain to you that is the area of the village which has seen the most development and the most change over a very short period of time. So I am aware that there are quite a lot of us. We have to walk along the main road to get up to the Young Offenders Institution and the prison area. The pavement is not very wide just there, so just please be aware the road is a busy road, even though we're in a nice village. We get lots of people that use these roads. And you're probably best just walking two by two along the road. So we're going to head out of the main gate of the car park. You can't get lost. We're going to turn right and then turn left. And the prison is the last stop on the left-hand side.
What does the name Puckle Church mean?
Puckle Church, there's a lot of discussion about what it means. You'll find that it's recorded in lots of books that it's to do with the derivation pulchra, which means beautiful, and church. Mm. The first place that it's written down is in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Mm. And it's written down as Pukela Kirken, which is to do with the church, but where the puck bit comes from, nobody actually knows. It's not actually a Saxon word for, you know, like a field or a river or a valley or anything like that. It might be a Saxon name. So it may well be the church which is built on the land that belonged to this person or the area that belonged to this person. But we can't be certain.
It's not pub, mischievous spirit.
It's possible. There are lots and lots of suggestions, but there's no absolute derivation. Okay?
Yeah. Is the Durham battle site? Can you see it from here?
Durham is in where I said the strip linchets were.
Yeah.
That's where Durham Park is. and that's where the Battle of Durham was supposed to be.
That was the scene of the battle.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one seems to mention that battle, but it was very pivotal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is pivotal in the history of the Saxons, yeah.
Yeah, and splitting up the old cut.
Yes, yeah. All right, so, onwards the foot. Yes, we've just walked by a big property down there on the right-hand side called the Poplars, and we're now right on the edge of the village. And 70 years ago, this was a field, and the field was called Ashfield. And lo and behold, now we have a Young Offenders Institution, which is called Ashfield YOI, and it does pay reference to the field name. So we've got a reference, but 70 years ago, it was a field. The road network, I talked about the road network coming into the village and skirting round this great big field. A lot of these roads are ancient roads and ancient networks. And we've got a track which runs behind, so from the corner of the main road, it runs behind Ashfield YOI and behind what is now the industrial estate, and that's called Back Lane. And that's an old green way which goes for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles in that direction towards Bath. We've also got an old turnpike road, which is the one that goes up towards Hinton. And there's also evidence to show, remember I talked about the Romans, that a lot of these trackways were probably Roman trackways too. You might remember that we had an application locally for an in-vessel composter to be built alongside the motorway on Batchfield Lane. And Batchfield Lane in the past has been called Burbarrow Lane, and it suggested that Burbarrow Lane is actually a Roman trackway. So we could have had them on that one as well, but they went away. So the IVC would have been right next to where the Romans had been travelling. There's a Roman road that comes up from Bitton and skirts along the top, along the bottom edge of the parish through Shortwood. So lots and lots of the trackways here are ancient ones. This is not ancient at all. So 1938, preparation for defence actually, a whole survey was done of the country to look for areas which, you know, potentially could come under threat. This was, you know, sort of preempting the Second World War. And a whole regional survey was done. And obviously the areas that they were thinking about protecting were the docks in Bristol and Avonmouth, and also the Filton Works, so the aero engine industry in that area, for protection. And one of the things that they came up with was that they would need to provide barrage balloons. And for this area, Pucklechurch was identified to become the centre for the distribution of those balloons. And where the industrial estate is now and where the remand centre is now, and going in that direction all the way across to literally to the main road as it goes all the way up through Absurn, was number 11 balloon squadron. And some of the buildings that are still on the industrial estate are associated with that balloon base. So at that time it wasn't actually called RAF Pucklechurch. It didn't become RAF Pucklechurch until 1957. But it was a base for training, for the assembly and for the distribution of barrage balloons. So barrage balloons at that time, the most popular one, or the one that they tended to use, was something like 65 feet long and 25 feet in diameter, and accommodated 19,000 cubic feet of gas, hydrogen gas. And the hydrogen gas was supplied by works along the Avonmouth industrial area. And so, obviously, if you've got things like that and you need to test them, you need great big hangers to test them in, and that's what some of those are in there. They've still been left in, and they're used as part of one of the distribution companies. And also some of the squadron officers have been left in there too. So this whole area here, I've seen a map of the area during that time. We've got great big fuel dumps, all kinds of buildings associated with it. And to start off with, there are three squadrons, balloon squadrons, which moved out of here to other bases within Bristol and in the surrounding areas. So the way the barrage balloons worked, essentially, the balloon went up, it was on cables. And if a plane flew into the cable actually detached itself and it had parachutes attached to the cable. So the plane flew into the cable and the parachutes provided sufficient drag to literally stop a bomber in its tracks and cause it to crash. But very cleverly, the cable also detached part of the balloon to let the balloon itself down very gently, and so it didn't crash on the people below it. That's how I understand it. And it's something like 6 times the power of the bomber, the drag coefficient on these cables. The site itself was identified by the Luftwaffe as a target. And Pucklechurch itself wasn't directly hit by bombs during the war. There was one bomb which landed on St Oldham's farm in the driveway. But this was never, there was never an attack on Pucklechurch balloon base. It was identified as GB2516, target 2516, spare ballon lager, so the balloon barrage balloon store in Luftwaffe records. But they never targeted it. The first attack on Bristol was the 24th of November 1940. That's when about 130 bombs delivered their load, slap bang into the city centre. That was the first major one. And the last one, the last time we were attacked, was in 1944. But by that stage, the barrage balloons were already becoming obsolete and things were starting to wind down. And the base itself started to be used as a servicing depot as opposed to a barrage balloon centre. And people came here to learn how to service radios and things like that. It was also a reservist centre for the training of RAF reservists. So the barrage balloon sort of went into abeyance and it started to be used for other things. It became a language school in 1957. It became a language school for people who were learning how to speak Russian. Because obviously we had lots of Russian people in Britain at that time, not. And then it became a language school for teaching RAF personnel Chinese. And actually what we now know is that these were all to do with covert operations, particularly during the Cold War. So essentially we had spies being trained how to speak Russian and Chinese in Pucklechurch after the war had ended. And that's now commemorated on a plaque in the church. So the RAF Linguists Association came a couple of years ago. We had a flypast with a Hercules transport plane flew over the church. There was a big service in the church and there was a plaque dedicated to the RAF Linguists Association. We weren't the only place in the country, obviously, that they were teaching people foreign languages. But we're one of them. And the Raffling Association are putting together a history of those language schools. You know, as we speak, really. They haven't produced it yet, but they're promising me lots and lots of documents about it so I can know a little bit more about the language school. So 1957, there was a language school here. Everything started to wind down. They started to move things out of the village altogether. And the RAF base was due to be closed in 1959 altogether. When it became the language school, it did actually get the name RAF Pucklechurch, and it was given its own badge. And if you bear in mind where we're standing is part of, or was part of, the ancient Kingswood Forest, the badge that it was given was a hind. And the picture of the hind, so for the deer, was on the front, and the word was alert. And it was to do with being alert during the war and the barrage balloon. So that's where the badge came from for RAF Pucklechurch. But it was due to be closed in 1959, and then I've seen it described as there was an increase in east-west tensions, so the Cold War got colder, and they put off the closure for another 2 years. So it was officially closed in 1961, and the western part of it was sold off to the Home Office to build Her Majesty's Remand Centre, so a prison for prisoners on remand here. And that's the whole of this area just here. And the eastern part of the site was turned into, as you can see, a small industrial estate. And that's changed over the last 20 years as well. And obviously that's changed over the last 20 years. So the Remand Centre was opened in 1965. If you go onto the internet and you put in searches to do with HM Remand Centre, Pucklechurch, you'll find out it says, you know, the most famous inmate was Stephen Fry. And Stephen Fry was on remand here for credit card fraud. Apparently he'd stolen a family friend's credit card and he was sent to Pucklechurch. What they don't tell you is towards the end of its life as a remand centre was that Rose West, Fred West's wife, was kept on remand at Pucklechurch. But that was after it had become a women-only institution. So in 1990, you'll remember that there were the Strange Ways prison riots, and that sparked off, there were a whole series of them around the country. There were 25 prisons where riots were sparked off. And if you read all the reports, it says things to do with overcrowding and unsanitary conditions and things like that. And Puckle Church is listed as one of the top six out of those 25 for the worst damage that was done. And we have a gentleman who was here on that night. So you can tell us what it was like in the remand centre.
I used to work as an officer in the old prison, and I can always remember it. I was actually off duty on the weekend when it actually kicked off, and I lived in the prison quarter down around the corner. I had a phone call about 5 o'clock, and I was in the guard room with welly boots on, and they said, "You better get out of the prison quick." So I didn't even bother to get a change. I went up there, and as soon as I got up there, the prisoners already started to climb up on the roof, and we got in riot gear, and basically it just escalated. The prisoners have, what they actually done is the evening duty staff had come on duty, and one of them was taken hostage, knocked unconscious, and his keys taken off him, and the prisoners on that particular unit unlocked all the rest of the prisoners, and then went down the main corridor, and I think there was somewhere about 7 or 8 officers on duty, and they was told to actually clear the buildings, else there's going to be major problems. So the staff were kind of evacuated to the gate area, and the prisoners unlocked themselves, and the riot started. And I was there all that night and the following day, and I think it was up until about 3:30 on Sunday afternoon it came to a close. But it was noted as one of the most violent out of the six. Prisoners gained access to things like the kitchen, and they had meat cleavers and various knives and various other things like that. They laid booby traps for staff, and it was quite a violent incident. The amount of damage, it was the only prison involved in the riots of 1990 which never reopened. The prison was in two halves. One was a female side, wasn't affected by the riots, and the other side was the male side, and that was the ones which had all the riot in. And the damage was bad afterwards, because they had several fires in there as well. And when we was actually in the buildings trying to get the prison back, we had kind of oxygen cylinders from the hospital exploding and various other things happening. But after the riots, and there was so much damage, they decided to actually close it. So it's the only prison that actually closed. The female side of the prison stayed on for about another 2 years before they moved to Eastwood Park, and then they kind of bulldozed it and put up the new prison, which is now a private prison.
Is that during that night, I live about 500 yards in that direction, and the first thing I knew about the riot was when I drove out of the village the next morning and saw the BBC Points West outside vans. I mean, we didn't hear any noise, I didn't know what was going on, there was nothing really to give us any indication of living further down in the village, unless you'd been in and out during the night and seen flames or noise or vans or things like that, that anything was going on in there. So thank you, Bill, for that.
Well, we used them all slippers and that, so they could do it silently.
Do it quiet during the night. Yeah, so Bill didn't know I was going to ask him to do that, so thank you very much for doing that.
No, basically what happened is that we're in a riot situation. The prison staff deploy within the prison, and the police deploy outside. So the old prison area was actually surrounded by police to prevent anyone, if they tried to escape over the walls, then they'll be arrested by the police. And the prison officers were responsible for gaining control inside.
So the remand centre for adults was closed. All the women were shipped off to Eastwood Park. The whole area was bulldozed, and then they decided to build the Young Offenders Institution. And that was the first, that has the epithet, that's the first one that was allowed to be run by a private company on behalf of the government. So it was significant from that perspective. It was also significant again in 2002 because there was another riot inside the YOI. And if you read all the newspaper reports about that one, they were trying to ship out 172 young men who were in there. They left 40 behind because it wasn't considered that it was being run effectively by the company, and within all of the documents that relate to the way that it's run, the government could actually take back control of the site. So there was another riot there in 2002, but since then the governorship has changed, and all of the reports about what happens inside the YOI are very positive, that it has improved a lot, the conditions in there have improved a lot, and the way things are run has improved a lot, and they've got very good reports from it. So it's a completely different situation to the one that we had in 2002. It's registered for 400 young men between the ages of 15 and 18. But I think that the latest report has actually said that it's advised that there are only 300 that are in there at any one time because of space. So has anybody got any more questions about the prison or the RAF base or anything like that? I said one thing this morning when I was reading through my notes about the RAF base was that it was once misidentified by an American aircraft as Filton, which is in that direction, and the aircraft landed on a field in Pucklechurch. And now I've got to find out which field, because I need to answer that question in my head, which field the American aircraft actually landed and took off from, even though it only had about 200 yards to do it in, according to the record. So I'm going to go and try and find somebody who lived in the area who knew about that. So that's my mission, anyway, to find out about that. What we're going to do now is we're doing a little bit of a detour away from the centre of the village. We're going to go... Sorry.
Did the Mirage balloons ever bring down a plane?
Yes, they did. Yeah, so there are records of them. If you want to read more detail about Number 11 Balloon Squadron, John Penny of the Fishponds Local History Society is the, you know, he is the genius. He's put all the records together from the war. He knows exactly what happened when. He's got records of what planes were doing what sorties they were on and what came down on what date. And that's on the Fishponds Local History website. And you can get a link to it via the pucklechurch.org community website too. So if you go onto links just there, that will take you straight through to what John has written about Pucklechurch and its balloon centre. So the reason that we've come here is because this is called King's Lane. And this is where King Edmund's body, once he'd been assassinated, was reputedly carried on its way to Glastonbury Abbey. So that's the story. King's Lane in that direction, it's a very nice walk. If anybody wants to go down, it's a very nice walk. You end up at a field and footpaths. It gets a bit boggy in the winter and a bit overgrown in the summer, but it is a very nice walk. This is probably the oldest part of the village, or one of the oldest parts of the village. In behind that wall, and we'll see it more on the corner as we walk back out again, there's a house which is currently called Moat House, and that's number 6. You've probably got a better picture on here than you'll be able to see from the road. It's a privately held house, and originally it probably had 7 gables, and it's not always been called Moat House. It's been variously called Pucklechurch Hall, and it's been called the Great House. It's probably on the original site of the manor of Pucklechurch, and it does have a moat, and we know that because when some work was done for a new house that's been built just a bit further down the lane, archaeologists discovered the remains of part of the moat along one side of it. So it was a defended medieval house with a moat around the outside of it, and it may actually be that that is where the real sort of Saxon seat of power was. The other thing to bear in mind is that we still don't find any Saxon pottery, but we did find Roman things, so could equally be a Roman site as well. Behind us we've got the grey house. And what you'll also have noticed as you've gone round is that some of the fantastic pieces of architecture that we've got in the village have been highlighted, but not all of them. There are something like 45 houses that have local listing, 16th and 17th century properties in and around the conservation area. And I went for a walk around the village with a new conservation officer about 3 or 4 weeks ago from the council to look at what had not been included within the conservation area, which is quite different to this little central bit just here. And one of the things which has not been included is Denisworth House, which was formerly known as Dodd's Farm, which is right opposite where the YOI is. And the Dennis family were a very important family within the village, and the Dennis family also used to live in the Moat House. And it is reputed that William III came to stay with them at the Moat House on his way back from the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. So we have another regal connection that King William III may well have slept in this house. But we can't prove it either way. It is recorded in various documents that that's what he did. It's hard to track. I actually don't know who lives in the Grey House. Does anybody know who lives in the Grey House? Has anybody ever met him? Mr. Bond.
James Bond.
He's a nice man. Will he let me in so I'm a look around? I've never been in that one before. I've only lived here for 21 years and always wondered. It's a private house. Yeah, so there are, you know, that's my favourite one. This is the one that Lynn says she's buying when she wins the lottery. My favourite one, and if you've got time before you leave the village, and don't mind looking in somebody else's windows, is Crump House, which is the one behind the poplars. So it is the prettiest, isn't it? Yeah. So what you've got to do is just walk around this whole central area of the village, and I would recommend doing this, and you'll see some of the lovely architecture that we've got. Anyway, let's walk back down King's Lane. You can briefly look over the hedge where it's been thinned recently and see the great Heather Moat House just there. And then... Sorry,
I was just going to say, the Grey House, Moat House, Denisworth, Crump House, are they all of a...
They're all roughly the same period. Yeah. There's major building that goes on in the centre of the village in the 16th and 17th century.
You said William stayed here.
Yes.
It was a main route from Bristol to London, wasn't it?
And Oxford.
And whereabouts was the sort of London road from where we are now?
It would be through up the Turnpike Road, up through Hinton in that direction. That would be the main road, as far as I'm aware, anyway. You see, I'm a prehistorian. I'm not a modern historian.
Are you competing with Iron Acton in that claim? Because the,
I don't the, know, are we?
Yeah, the lamb in Iron Acton. They've got a bedroom with a coat of arms. They claim that William stayed there on the way back.
But it is definitely written down that he came here in lots of documents.
Oh, it's written down.
It's written down.
You're a better claim than them.
I'll set my bedroom up with a crest in it, shall I? William stayed here. Right, we're going to go to the end of the road and turn right. That'll be when he's gone to play golf, Jackie. We're going to go to the end of the road, turn right, and head up Parkfield Road. Up towards number 7, and you can see we're coming back on ourselves and coming up towards the church. Parkfield Road, that's the name of the colliery. If you go all the way to the end of Parkfield Road and turn right, the road bends right and actually it comes to a dead end, apart from an unadopted road that leads to a couple of private properties. Parkfield Rank was a rank of cottages that were built by Sir Handel Cosham for the colliery workers. So they're exploiting the coal seams that lie under Shortwood and Pucklechurch and the Kingswood area. And that was built in 1851. So a couple of shafts were sunk. And it was in operation until the beginning part of the 20th century when it started to flood. So I think it's 1936 that it closed altogether. But the coal itself was starting to be played out and they were having terrible problems with flooding. What's quite interesting, though, is if you go on to... there's a database online, a catalogue of documents that are held by various record officers, and it's called A2A, Access to Archives. And if you put a search in there on Pucklechurch and Bristol, or Pucklechurch and Gloucester Record Office, you'll get a list of various documents that are things like the coroner's office records for deaths and burials, accidental deaths and burials. And there's a whole set there... to do with colliers that were killed in accidents at Parkfield Colliery, and it's various things to do with foul air, or there's one where a carter backed his cart backwards and went down a shaft, and various other accidents just there. And even though you're not looking at the actual documents themselves, it gives you a flavour of what exactly was going on in the village. So I'm going to write that one up as well, about death and burial in the village. So Parkfield is in that direction, and if you have bought your car with you today and you don't know Pucklechurch at all, it's worth a look, because the architecture down there is completely different. It is mining cottages. They are terraced with very long, thin gardens that run out of the back of them. They were built in the middle of the 19th century for the colliery workers. The colliery opened in 1851. And obviously Sir Handel Cosham is the one who endowed Cosham Hospital. And he was an incredibly intelligent man, and he wrote various other treatises as well. And there are lots of records in one of the records office you can read about on that website too. So some of you are already reading who I'm going to talk about in particular, but I did some research into a family called Swain, and it came in a roundabout sort of way. I get inquiries sent to me now from a variety of different places, either through the Puckle Church website or through the South Gloucestershire website, and some of them are looking for family history information, some of them are looking for other kinds of information. And an Australian lady had asked me to look in the churchyard for tombstone information relating to a completely different family. And I came in one Sunday morning to wander around, and just wandered around here casually reading this one, and alighted upon this one, which is Sir Eric John Eagle Swain, let's say CBE-KCMG, who was the former Commander-in-Chief of British Somaliland and Governor of British Honduras. And so, of course, my brain, being the kind of brain it is, thinks, why is he buried in Puckle Church? What's he got to do with us? And at the same time, some of you will know that I'm Curator of Archaeology at the City Museum in Bristol. I'd been talking to our Curator of the Biological Collections, and she told me that there was a vicar in Puckle Church who'd written a very famous treatise on pasture grasses, and he'd put together herbarium. So he collected different species of pasture grasses, and the idea was that this could then be used by local farmers to improve the land. And that we've got this, it's called Gramina pascua, a copy of it in Bristol. It's one of our best, you know, items in the collection, in the herbaria collections. And I said, oh, that's interesting then. I'll go and find out about the vicar that it belonged to. Didn't know what his name was. And started looking into this chap and then realised that they belonged to the same family. So Sir Eric was the Reverend George Swains, who made the herbarium's grandson. This is Sir George. This was the Reverend George's son. So this is George, father of Sir Eric. And the cross next to him is to George Gustav Carlos Swain. You'll notice that he was only 2.5 when he died. And if you look along this whole row just here, you'll find out that this is the Swain family burial plot. And the Reverend Swain was vicar in the village for 60 years. And if you go into the church when it's open, this window just here is a memorial to him. And it's a memorial to him for the 60 years that he was here, and also his 6 sons and 3 daughters who are buried close by. Unfortunately, I haven't managed to identify all of the sons and daughters, and they're not all here anyway. So anyway, Sir Eric John, Commander, what's he got to do with Somaliland, and what's this family got to do with Puckle Church? So we've got the Reverend who made the herbarium. This chap just here was actually chaplain to Princess Alice, Queen Victoria's daughter, in Germany. So he went off, he was a royal chaplain. He had several children. That kind of explains, you know, he was in Germany, he also worked in France, he worked in Switzerland, lots of mainland European countries, and his children ended up with names like Gustav and Dagmar, and names that have got all this Germanic inspiration. And Gustav, George Gustav, was actually the oldest of the children. And so I started to do this whole family tree to find out how they were all connected. Unfortunately, he met his death, a very sticky ending. They put him to bed just after Christmas, in one January evening, for a nap in the afternoon, and went up to check on him at the tea time, and discovered that a charcoal had spit out of the fire onto the bedclothes and set the bedclothes on fire. And so they discovered him dead, probably dead of smoking inhalation. And I've got the coroner's records to show me exactly what happened, and it was reported in all the newspapers. So he would have been the eldest son. Sir Eric was actually the 3rd son of George. The 2nd son was called Harold. And it's Harold's fault that Eric ended up in Somaliland. Harold Carlos Swain was a bit of an adventurer and an explorer. He was also an artist. His sister Dagmar was a sculptress in Paris. He'd spent some time in a studio there with her. He joined the army and he ended up in India. And this was at a time when the Indian government were asking people to reconnoitre, to do reconnaissance missions in and around what we would now call Somalia. And so he went into Somalia at the end of the 1880s, the beginning of the 1890s. And he actually had a band of Somalis with him. He didn't take other Royal Engineers with him, other army officers. He actually had a band of about 30 Somalis. He took time to learn the Somali language. He travelled. He made maps. He was using lots of relatively primitive surveying equipment by modern standards anyway. And he made maps of particular areas of that side of Somaliland and brought back the information for the Indian government. And so he became an envoy, if you like, into Somalia. There's one incident in his notebooks which actually explains how he is attacked by a lion and very badly mauled, and his life is only saved by Eric, who shot the lion at very close quarters. And then they carried on and continued to do this mapping exercise, and that's where all the maps of the interior of Somalia came from at that period of time. So Eric obviously was introduced to Somalia. So there was a change of government. The Indian government gave over the protectorate, if you like, of Somalia to the Foreign Office. So the Foreign Office started to become in control of the protectorate. And I'm no expert on that particular era of history, but there was lots of intertribal warfare, and obviously there were groups of people who disapproved of the colonial settlements there too. And so there's lots and lots of fighting that goes on. And Eric was in the right place at the right time, and they went to Eric rather than Harold to take a force into Somalia to put down some of these insurrections. And he led at least four expeditions against somebody who was termed at the time the Mad Mullah, but whose name is actually Muhammad al-Abdullah Hassan. He's got various different spellings, but he was phrased as the Mad Mullah, but essentially he was fighting for the freedom of a particular area of Somalia against the empire, who they saw as the invaders. And as a result of that, Eric ended up becoming the commander-in-chief of the British forces in Somalia until about 1903, and then he was made the governor of British Honduras. He left the Honduras in 1906, and he came back to Britain, and he did various things during the First World War. He was in charge of recruitment during the First World War, and he retired in 1919, and obviously had a 10-year retirement before he died in 1929. And came back to Pucklechurch to be buried here. He was born in Darmstadt in Germany, but the draw back to Pucklechurch for the family was such that most of the family are buried here. Harold is not buried here, he's buried in Jersey. He was married three times, an incredibly interesting man, and you can get hold of his book, his pioneer notebooks, and you can read what actually happened to him, and it's all very sort of boy's own gung-ho type language. But it's another world, it's a completely other world that you're introduced to. And there are pictures of them as well. So I now know what Eric looked like, and I know what Harold looked like. What I don't know is what their cousin looked like yet. And the cousin is buried a bit down there. She is the daughter. She's called Frances Louisa Swain. And she went to Somaliland too, obviously because of the family connections. And she went there on a three-month trip, and she wrote a book which was published in 1907 by a Bristol publisher. And it was called A Pleasure Trip in Somaliland, and it's her recollection of the time that she was there. And these books now, they're incredibly rare. There's one in the British Library, there are a couple at the Bodleian, there's one at Edinburgh University, there's one in a shop, I'm not going to tell you where it is because I'm going to buy it. But they vary in price between £200 is the cheapest one I found, and £1,395. They are so rare. This is a Victorian lady explorer related to the Swains, who's written this book, and she is now quoted when people are doing gender studies at university and things like that, and they're looking at this particular period of time, they look at Frances Louisa Swain's book, and she's buried just down there, and it says she's the daughter of Joseph Griffith Swain, who was another member of the family, and he's another story because he's a very famous researcher into anaesthetics, obstetrics, and also one of the forerunners for the discovery of the cause of cholera. And he lived in Bristol. So we have this sort of connection with Somalia in Pucklechurch. There are other diplomats that are buried around here, so that's my next next job, various other people that are buried in this corner of the churchyard. One other aside, you'll notice that he's called George Carlos Swain. His son was called George Gustav Carlos Swain. The Eagles comes from his mother's maiden name, and the Carlos is a mother's maiden name that's been passed down through several centuries. And the story goes that it comes from Colonel William Carlos, who was responsible, one of those responsible, for hiding Charles in the oak tree after the Battle of Shrewsbury. And this oak tree was called the Boscobel Oak. And the Carlos name is passed down through the family. And actually, the Griffith Swain family used to live in a house on Pembroke Road in Bristol called Boscobel House. So obviously they knew the story and they knew that they were descendants. It's just another royal connection. We've got Queen Victoria's daughter, but we've also got King Charles associated with the family as well.
Okay. Yes. Just a quick question. Do you know if any of the Somali community from Bristol have been here?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. But it is something that, you know, we've got stuff in the museum collections which the Swains donated. You know, they were part of the things like the Bristol Philosophical and Literary Society, the forerunners of the museum, the Bristol Institution and things like that. And it's the, you know, I brought it to the attention of my colleague who deals with all of that kind of material and said, you know, this is the kind of thing that we can actually use with other communities that are living in and around Bristol now, so that we've got the relevance. But it's only because I wandered around that Sunday morning that I read the and thought, why has he got anything to do with Puckle Church? There is an amazing family tree that somebody in Australia has put together, of which the Swains are one line. And the more you look at it, there are bishops that are descended from the Reverend George. There are obviously, you know, we've got the big game hunters, the explorers. We've got other spies that are descended from him. And actually, one of his great nephews was the man who gave the order to sink the General Belgrano. So the more you go into it, there's more, you know. You know, there's all these people with notorieties. There are murderers. There's all kinds of stuff. There's a son-in-law that shot one of them in a fit of pique in the middle of the night. It's incredible. Behind me is a field which is a scheduled ancient monument. And it's scheduled because it's recorded that in 946 AD, King Edmund the Magnificent was murdered here. Whether he was murdered in this field or not is complete conjecture. There is no evidence to support it whatsoever. Not a single shred. There are archaeological features that run across the field and also in the field behind this row of houses just here. And there was an excavation that was done very rapidly when some of these houses were built in 1964. And it's not incredibly well written up. It's not written up to the same standard as I would expect a report to be written today. We don't know where any of the material's gone to. It was done by an amateur society, so we can't check anything that they've said. But from the descriptions of the objects, it doesn't sound like any of those are Saxon either. Why do we think it's in this field then? Well, we've got a verbal record of it, if you like. The reason that we're recorded, Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records in AD 946 that Edmund was murdered here in his palace, and it was at Puckle Church. You know, so it was at Puckle Church. This is something that's written within living memory of it actually happening. So that is without a doubt. We just don't know where the site is. This site has had nothing built on it for the last 400 years. In 1607, an antiquarian called Camden recorded that this area was known as Villa Regia. So a royal residence. When we're talking about a palace or a hunting lodge is probably the better description. We're not talking about something that's made out of stone. We're talking about an Anglo-Saxon hall which is constructed out of timber with a thatched roof. It's not something that's incredibly permanent, and it is the one thing in the archaeological record which will disappear completely apart from post holes or stains in the soil where the timbers have actually been set into the ground. So it doesn't leave very much evidence. And if you speak to other people who deal with Saxon palaces and hunting lodges, you'll know that they're incredibly difficult to find. There is one recorded at Cheddar in Somerset, which may have been used by Edmund. If you ever watch Time Team, you'll know that they go shooting off all over the place to look for Saxon buildings and very often don't find anything. And did go looking for a Saxon palace elsewhere and still didn't find it. It's a bit like putting a needle, you know, in a map and thinking, is it there, is it there, is it there? There's nothing that suggests it's in here. So Camden records that it is in a field behind a public house or an inn, and the star's been here for a very long time, or a public house, an inn's been on this site for a very long time, and that he was riding in from the Dirham area, and that he rode in, and on the side of the hill he could see the lumps and bumps and the remains of where Edmund's palace was. But as far as I'm aware, he had no reason to believe that those lumps and bumps were the exact site. I think it's an assumption that he makes. I'm just going to get down, so I need to get something out of my pocket. I'm going to show you how the story gets embellished over time. So, and I'm going to do it in English, modern English. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says, this year, King Edmund died on St. Augustine's Mass Day, which is the 26th of May. That was widely known how he ended his days. That Leif stabbed him at Pucklechurch. And Ethelfleda of Damerham, daughter of Alderman Elgar, was then his queen. And he reigned 6 years and a half, and then succeeded to the kingdom Edred Atling, his brother, who soon after reduced all the land of the Northumberland to his dominions. And the Scots gave him oaths that they would do all that he desired. So about half of that is about how Edmund was murdered here, and the rest is about his family and what they did afterwards. Camden writes, this is written in 1607, Avon, shedding itself into Severn, running cross before it, maketh a division between Gloucestershire and Somersetshire, and not far from the bank thereof, Pucklechurch appeareth, being in times past a town or manor of the king's, called Pucklechurchers, wherein Edmund, King of England, while he interposed himself between his sewer, steward, and one Louis, or Leif, a most villainous wretch, fought apart and end certain quarrels between them, was thrust through the body and so lost his life. So suddenly we've got a character, the steward now has appeared in the story, and that gets embellished again by somebody called Rudder, who wrote A New History of Gloucestershire, which was new in 1799. And the story gets passed on. And the one which is the most embellished that I've got a copy of, this was written in a magazine that was produced in Chipping Sodbury in December 1878. And this one's really nice because this will have some relevance to your reenactment later. It says, near the highway leading to Dirham, standing on some rising ground, is a house which is built on the very spot where once stood the palace of the Saxon kings, which, judging by the ruins and hillocks still remaining, must have been a very large extent. It was in this palace that King Edmund the First was slain. A certain robber named Leif, for his many and great crimes, had been banished from the country and declared outlaw. On the festival of St. Augustine in the year 946, King Edmund held a large banquet, and Leif, mingling unnoticed with the guests, seated himself at one of the tables in the great hall. He was, however, recognised after a time, and the circumstances told to the king, who arose from his seat in great wrath, and striding to the offender, angrily asked how he dared to disobey the royal command by showing his face at that assembly, concluding by desiring that Leif would immediately leave the apartment. This the robber refused to do. One angry word followed another until King Edmund, out of all patience at the obstinacy and insolence of the fellow, rushed towards him with the intention of turning him out of the palace by force. But such a movement had been anticipated by the man, and quick as thought, drawing a dagger, he plunged it into the king's breast, who fell with a groan and in a few minutes was dead. The murderer then tried to escape, but was overpowered by numbers and literally cut to pieces by the enraged warriors present. Okay, so this is another version of the story. We don't know what happened to Leif. We have no idea what happened to him, whether he escaped or any of that. We don't know exactly whether he was defending his steward or anything. I will tell you something a bit more about Edmund, though. Edmund the Magnificent was an amazing warrior. He was Alfred the Great's grandson, and he had succeeded his older brother, his half-brother Athelstan, as king, and had actually fought at quite a number of battles. He was only 25 when he died, but when he was 16 he fought at a major battle which was somewhere on the Wirral. Nobody knows exactly where it is, but this place is called the Battle of Brunanburh, or Brunanburh, depending on how you want to pronounce it, and this is you know, it's described by some writers as being on a par with Culloden and some of the other major turning points in British history. This was at a point in time where Athelstan was fighting Vikings and invaders and things like that, and it was after this battle. There were several other kings and other leaders that were murdered or got killed as a result of this battle. That's really when England, as England, started to become one nation, if you like. It all fell apart when Edmund became king, because there were more incursions and more invasions, and he ended up having to fight again to retake some of the territories. But he fought in this battle when he was 16, and he got this epithet, the Magnificent, or Doer of Deeds, as a result of that. There are other stories about him. There's one story that is recorded about a miraculous incident in Cheddar Gorge when he was out hunting and nearly fell down into the ravine, and Dunstan records that he was actually saved, and it was a miracle that he was actually saved. He was likely to have used this area here, or an area in Pucklechurch, for a hunting lodge because of the Kingswood Forest. You know, there would have been hunting lodges for him to be in, and I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that he was murdered in Pucklechurch. What we do doubt is it's in that field behind the Star. If anything, I came out one, it was the day after New Year's Day a couple of years ago, and it was absolutely freezing and very cold and wet, with my friend who is a landscape archaeologist, and he had permission to do a geophysical survey of the field from the owners and from the government. And we went in, you know, if you've seen him on Time Team kicking one of those things around all day, and put all the results into a computer and came out with absolutely nothing apart from some white blodgers that meant nothing. But what we noticed as we were putting the machine onto the ground was that there were some areas that were particularly rocky. And there are some large stones in the middle of that field that have come from somewhere else, and they've probably been dumped there at some point in the last 400 years. On the tithe map, it's a field called Pitching House Close, but that doesn't actually reveal what the field was used for. But it certainly had nothing built on it for the last 400 years. And I would very much doubt anything to do with the Anglo-Saxons. When it's scheduled, it was scheduled in the 1950s, you can see, you have to look very carefully, but you can see banks and ridges. One of the other suggestions was that it was an Iron Age site as opposed to any other site. But the stone wouldn't have anything to do with the Iron Age site. The banks and the ditches would. So if anything, my guess is that there's been a house that's been demolished in the past, some of it has been dumped in that field at some point, and it's all been grown over, and now it's only ever used for grazing. So there endeth the walk in Pucklechurch, there endeth Edmund, except for the reenactment, and that's all I've got to say, unless anybody's got any questions to ask me. Large parts of it would have been, we're on the edge of the Kingswood Forest just here, yes. Yeah. Any more questions? No? Good, thank you very much.
Can I just say, give a big round of applause for Gail? On behalf of Bristol Radical History Group,
no
thanks
problem.
Very much for giving up your morning on this really cold day. Thanks.